The Guardian.
A devastating week for Manchester and the United Kingdom. Campaigns were suspended as politicians united to condemn the worst terrorist attack here in more than a decade.
Today, the country will see a low-key return to campaigning as the general election draws ever closer. In fact, it's just 2 short weeks from today.
I'm Owen Jones.
And I'm Jonathan Friedland, and this is Election Daily.
First off, joining us down the line is Helen Pidge. She's the Guardian North of England editor. Now, Helen, you've been tweeting tirelessly, reporting from the streets of Manchester since the attack. Now, I've sold out my Cunion roots, but it is true to say that there is so much warmth, strength in Manchester. People really do look out for each other. And we've seen that, haven't we, in the aftermath of this terrible atrocity?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes you can overdo the Manc spirit stuff. And, you know, if you'd asked me last week, I might have rolled my eyes about this sort of thing. You know, Mancunian saying they live in the best place in the world when it's chucking it down half the time. And yet, what we have seen here is, you know, real warmth and a lot of it kind of tinged with a bit of Manc humour. Just the fact that so many of you wanted to pay for a pint for the medics at the Royal Manchester Infirmary. Last time I checked, it was like £11,000 going to be put behind the bar at the pub nearby. And those signs saying, you know, ISIS can't scare us, we're Manc. And, you know, walking around the streets, there's still people giving out free chocolates and bottles of water. So it is something to kind of hold on to in these pretty dark times.
How much of this has been spontaneous and how much of it has been led by the political leadership of the city? Because we've seen Andy Burnham, we've seen Richard Leese. How much have they been leading this, or has it been coming up from the bottom up?
I don't think they've been leading it. I mean, they've been pitch perfect, I think, in their response. But look at what got the biggest reaction at the incredibly moving vigil on Tuesday night. It was a poem written by a Mancunian. And none of the politicians chose to speak at that event. They could have. They didn't. They just stood there on the stage. And I think they're sort of, in some ways, they're setting the tone. There are probably other cities that if they had planned this weekend to have a major sporting event, closing down roads very near where an attack had happened, they would just cancel it. But the Manchester City Council leaders are absolutely determined that the Great Manchester Games will go on this weekend. So in front of the town hall, they're going to have like a pole vaulting competition. Deansgate, one of the main thoroughfares, will become a 100-metre track.
And do people in the city feel that's the right call?
Yeah, definitely. I've not heard anybody complaining about that. I mean, it's nonsense to say that it's business as usual because it isn't. And you can see it on people's faces walking around. And it's, you know, I was in the city centre last night and United had just won the Europa Cup. And I would normally avoid Manchester City Centre if there's been a football match involving one of the two teams. But it was, you know, it was very muted. There was a little bit of singing that you could hear. But, you know, mostly it was pretty sombre and subdued.
The fear after a terrible terrorist attack like this is division, which is, you know, very much what the terrorists would like. How much is there a sense of unity that people in Manchester don't want to turn in on each other, if you like?
Well, it's hard to tell. You know, the vigil, the first vigil on Tuesday, there were people of all colours and creeds and religions and whatnot. And yet, you know, if you talk to people at the mosques, they are reporting anecdotally people being abused and told it's their fault and, you know, Muslims being asked to account for actions that have got absolutely nothing to do with them, you might say. So I don't think we should sugarcoat it and suggest that it is all one big happy family, because undoubtedly there are people who are feeling that they're being unfairly blamed or targeted for this.
Officially, campaigning resumes today. Do you think that's going to happen in Manchester? And if it does,
no.
Is there any kind of, well, you've just answered it. Tell us what the sort of appetite and energy is for politics.
I don't think there's any appetite at all. You know, on Monday nights, just before the attacks, I was at Hustings in Gorton, listening to George Galloway, wondering if he was going to do it yet again. But it just all feels so insignificant. I mean, my guess would be that in times like these, people will just fall back on their old voting patterns and will be less inclined to want to take a punt on something new. But I could be wrong. I've not heard anybody talking about the election.
No, and your sense is that will probably hold till June the 8th, I would guess.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think Manchester's going to get back to normal for quite some time, really.
Helen, thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Join us after this short break when senior Guardian reporter Ian Cobain will be joining us here in the studio. Now, the fallout from this attack has raised a lot of concerns for the UK's police and intelligence services. The biggest today centres on major security concerns following a leak of photographs from Monday night's attack, apparently by US intelligence. And Ian Cobain, senior Guardian reporter, is here with us now. Ian, just to begin with, can you just sort of sum up what's happened?
What's happened is that a number of photographs were taken at the scene of the crime. Were then shared with American law enforcement intelligence agencies. Some of those photographs have been leaked to the New York Times, along with a map which shows the location at which the bomber's body was found and the location at which his victims died. The photographs show a fragment of a rucksack, a battery, a part of a detonating system, and one or two other fragments from the bomb.
And the reaction of the British authorities has been unusually furious, actually.
Yes. Amber Rudd, by Wednesday, was expressing what she described as her irritation at the fact that the name of the bomber first emerged in the United States and wasn't released by the British government. So there was that loss of control. And the last night's leak has caused a great deal of concern within the British government and with the British law enforcement.
Perhaps it's pointless to speculate, but what motive do you think US intelligence officials have for leaking this stuff? We know after 7/7 something similar happened, but what exactly are they playing at, I suppose, is what lots of people will be thinking.
I would think that they probably think they're not playing at anything, and that this is a usual exchange, very common exchange. There is a greater willingness on the part of American officials to disclose information to the public through the media. It happens. There's not such a culture of secrecy in the United States as there is here. There's a greater culture of openness. After the 7/7 bombings in 2005, a car was found parked at Luton railway station in which there were a number of bombs. It's thought that possibly they were intended to be used by a fifth bomber who changed his mind. They were photographed. The photographs were sent to the United States, and within a matter of hours, they were being released to the ABC News network. This happens.
So the importance there is that some people had suspected a kind of Trump thing going on here, that because he has proven to be quite leaky with valuable intelligence, and that somehow perhaps this come from him. But you're saying the 7/7 example, the precedence is probably not.
It happens. I would say that DC is the leakiest city in the world. It has been for a very long time. British journalists have a long tradition of seeking information about Britain through the United States. It's the way it works in the United States.
And when the first of these leaks happened, there was some fear that it was going to imperil the investigation because they actually named the killer before he had been named by British authorities, and that meant you couldn't do surprise raids on his home or homes of his associates. The stuff that's just come out now, any risk that could jeopardise the investigation?
Well, to deal with the former first, if he did have associates, those associates know who he was. So they wouldn't be surprised by
it. But they might know that the police are on their case earlier than they would otherwise.
Yeah, I think they'd probably assume that the police would be on their case pretty quickly. I can quite understand the way in which police might want to very discreetly go and turn up at an address and search it without having the world's media watching them. I understand that. Last night's material, it's difficult to see how any of that could have impeded the investigation in any way. There was a photograph of a battery. Well, we knew the bomb had an ignition system. There was a photograph of fragments of a rucksack. I don't see why the British public shouldn't know that the bomb was in a rucksack rather than a vest. And I don't see how that can impede the investigation. And there was, oh, heaven forfend, we now know that he had the detonator in his left hand. Well, I don't see why this is a problem. It's a problem for a government that wants to control information, but I don't see how it impedes the investigation. I don't think its publication was irresponsible.
In terms of the consequences, Greater Manchester Police have said that they will stop sharing intelligence with the US intelligence services as a consequence. Do you think this will disrupt, in the long term, the relationship between the British and the American intelligence services?
No, I don't. I think that if they really were going to withhold information, that would be irresponsible. Not the publication of the photographs, but withholding information from our allies when the intelligence sharing arrangements are intended to actually save lives in the future, that would be deeply irresponsible. And because it would be deeply irresponsible, I don't think it's going to happen. It's just talk.
We've mentioned that the campaigning for the general election resumes officially anyway today. So just to put a sort of political angle on this, and it's hard, but it's inevitably going to happen. Some people, including, I think, Labour's Angela Rayner, have been saying, making the point about cuts in the police numbers over recent years. And there, that's just the sort of edge of beginning to see a political story here, that maybe government have bear some degree of responsibility because of the reduction in police numbers. What do you make of that as an argument?
I don't see how the campaigning could have ever ended. I'm not criticising anybody for that. Psychologically, I don't understand how you can separate your response to a terrorist attack and a mass murder from the campaign that's going on around you. I don't see how the Prime Minister could possibly be expected to have really done that. What does she do? Change her hat? Take the purple one off and put the blue one on or something? It's just not possible. I don't know that the public will be impressed by hearing politicians starting to attack each other over police numbers. And if the campaign starts to look at the way in which Islamist opponents of Gaddafi have been brought to this country and their children have been raised here, I think people have to be very careful about that. And because sooner or later, people will start asking which Home Secretary allowed them into the country. There's a whole...
And just since you've left that dangling there, we should be clear on this one. That would be a Tory era Home Secretary.
That would be Michael Howard, wouldn't it?
It was Michael Howard, just in case anyone thought you were making a Labour point.
I just we have to be really careful here, because it's we've already seen how a few photographs in the New York Times have caused inflamed a sort of political row. Once the campaigning starts getting properly underway, I think that it could. I'm quite concerned about where it would go, really.
On the issue of police cuts, of course, what I think people focused on is the mobilisation of soldiers, which I don't actually think, having spoken to people, will mean soldiers on the streets, but guarding key points. What I found, I had this fascinating comment left by a police officer, and he said, you know, he was glad of the army being available to assist, but saddened it's needed. And make no mistake, it's needed. The police are desperately understaffed, not just frontline officers, but civilian roles such as analysts and station managers and general inquiry officers have gone due to extensive cuts. They said, you know, those ones are identified problems, he said. The army being on the street helps ease pressure in maintaining cordons, allows officers to be free to do other roles, but in the long run, they can only be utilised as armed security guards. So what's your response to that? Because I thought that was quite a fascinating insight into what's going on the front line.
If they're being used to free up officers to do other duties, you can see the sense in that. But you have to wonder whether what appeals here is the optics of having men in uniform standing outside at the Buckingham Palace and showing that we have a strong, dare I say, stable response to these events.
But you're hinting there that there was some political decision making, and the counter argument to that has been this is a group of operational officers.
I just don't see how there can't be. How do you separate it in your mind? How do you think I'm going to put aside the fact that we're in the middle of a general election? That has no bearing upon my decision making whatsoever. Experience tells us that we can't do this. We can't do this. If most people's motives are mixed quite a lot of the times, then the decision making over the response to this act of mass murder has to be taken within the context of a general election. How can it not? How can it not? I think it's worth bearing something else in mind, which is the last time we deployed troops, we deployed them in a very specific location, which was in Heathrow. Some armoured vehicles, that's it. Now we're putting them out onto the streets, and it's slightly different. And as Jim Callaghan, as Home Secretary, said to Gerry Fitt in 1969, when Gerry Fitt was saying, can you please send us troops? Jim Callaghan, according to Fitt, said, yeah, I can put troops on the streets. Taking them off again is going to be a bit more difficult. And that proved to be the case.
And that is the big question with this one, whether they'll even be there still on the streets on polling day itself, something I wrote about yesterday, but also whether it goes on even longer than that. And you think about France, where a state of emergency is held, coming on for, well, nearly 2 years.
And turning these attacks and the consequences into the new normal is something that the attackers probably welcome, really. It is disturbing.
I mean, that's the more, I suppose, in terms of the other disturbing implications, which is the disruption to an election campaign and the political consequences. If in terms of, I'm trying to carefully choose my words here, not incentivize, well, incentivize terrorists. I mean, the impact of terrorism.
Disrupting an election, that will be a big win for them.
Absolutely. And other terrorists, aspiring terrorists, will look at this and look at a profound impact that was had on a democratic process, and they will take heart. That's the danger, surely.
Yes, and it will completely change the course of the election in Spain in 2004. Completely changed the course of that election. And
because they're so, we remember, the Spanish government, the Conservative government, they seem to be suggesting it was an attack by separatists, ETA, because they didn't want it to be Islamist because of the involvement in Iraq.
And the public thought they were being lied to, and they were, and they responded badly. And just to quickly go back to this question of leaks and intelligence sharing, acts of terrorism are tended to not just kill and maim the people in the immediate vicinity. They're intended to make victims of all of us. They're intended to cause all of us a great deal of alarm and distress. And when we're being made victims of these terrorist attacks, people feel disempowered if they don't know what's going on. And the opposite is true. They feel better if they have more information. And that's a good reason for disclosing this information, for making it public rather than trying to conceal it.
Well, thanks for all of that. Before we leave, it's our practice on the podcast to give you a little bit of recommended reading. And my first one is going to be something from The Guardian, actually, by Lucy Easthope, who is a senior lecturer specialising in disaster response at Lincoln University. She's written an opinion piece today, which is completely fascinating. It reveals, first of all, that everything that appears to happen spontaneously in the aftermath of these disasters is, in fact, meticulously planned. Even those I Heart Manchester signs and posters were all prepared and organised beforehand, and it happens in every city despite all that, and she being very pleased that the plan went off as foreseen. She now has regrets, and sort of not regrets exactly, second thoughts, and is wondering if perhaps all this pre-planning doesn't leave room for the spontaneous expression of loss that people feel rather than just these expressions of resilience and solidarity. It's a really interesting and unusual piece on today's opinion pages in print and on opinion on the website.
My article's from BuzzFeed. It's actually from the end of 2016, but it's about Martin Hett, who was a 29-year-old, sorry, from Stockport, my hometown, who died in the bombing. And this is a very emotional story, even at the time. Martin Hett had his mother had a craft fair, and no one bought anything. So he did an appeal, and on Twitter, everyone bought everything that his mum had put out to sale. It's just a heartwarming story. And the reason I bring it up is when a terrorist atrocity like this happens, what we should strive to do is, rather than focusing on the terrorist murderer, this pathetic individual whose last act was detonating himself in a crowd of smiling children and their parents, but instead to remember and indeed cherish the lives of those who died. And Martin Hett, by all accounts, was a very special and loved individual. And this story, I think, just showed what a terrible loss this was to Stockport, to Manchester, to all of us.
And that's on BuzzFeed, and we'll have a link to that on the page. And Ian?
I read about Martin Hett this morning in my Guardian, and I realised when I was sitting on the tube, realising what a wonderful person, you know, somebody brought joy to the nation in his own way, that he'd been taken away from us. I have to confess that I cried a little bit. However, the article that I would recommend that people read is the New York Times article, which includes the photographs from Manchester. It was in yesterday's New York Times. It's online today. Anybody reading that will understand a little bit more about what happened in Manchester. I think it's a great pity that we have to rely upon American journalists to tell us about acts of mass murder in Manchester.
That's all we've got time for on today's Election Daily. So do join us again on Monday. Tomorrow, The Guardian's political editor takes over again for Politics Weekly.
And remember, you can subscribe on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. I'm Jonathan Friedland.
And I'm Owen Jones.
And our producers were Phil Maynard and Gabriella Jones.
See you on Monday.
There's hard times again in these streets of our city. But we won't take defeat, and we don't want your pity, because this is the place where we stand strong together with a smile on our face, Mancunians forever, because this is the place in our hearts, in our homes, because this is the place that's a part of our bones, because Manchester gives us such strength from the fact that this is the place. We should give something back. Always remember, never forget, forever Manchester. Yeah. Choose love, Manchester. Thank you.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, Just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.